Our reading today is Esther chapter 2, Esther made queen. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem and the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther was also taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than that Hegai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, as Mordecai had told her to do so. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, 2 of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. And may the Lord bless his word to us. Let's just pray before Grant comes.
Now, if you're anything like me at school, and the teacher said, "Have you done your homework?" Usually my response would have been, "What homework?" So, for the benefit of those who are similar to me, I'm just going to do a very, very quick recap on chapter 1 to set the scene of where we're at. Persia, which is modern-day Iran, 483 BC. 100 years after the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar had taken the Jews into captivity. Now the Persian Empire is a dominant force and power in the Middle Central Asia. The king is King Xerxes. He's the ruler of the vast Persian Empire. Chapter 1. King Xerxes gives a big banquet at the citadel of Susa. For 180 days, he displays his immense wealth. Now, the Persian kings often held banquets before going into battle so they could pump themselves up to see how great they were. And, of course, it was very good for the military morale to know your king is so incredibly wealthy and powerful. So King Xerxes gets all his male dignitaries, or his lackeys or cohorts, whatever you want to say, together so they could basically drink as much as they could to get absolutely hammered. And that's what the text tells us, for 7 days. So after this big bash, this big booze up, and he's really full of himself and full of his own self-importance, that he's the top dog of his, and displaying his like autocratic power, he commands the beautiful Queen Vashti to come and parade herself in seductive attire, perhaps involving a dance performance to stir up his troops, well, to stir up the testosterone in the troops. But it was more about them ogling at her and drooling over what the king had than it was about anything else. It was the king saying, "Well, look, I've got absolutely everything. I've got this beauty here, Queen Vashti." And of course, I'm using very chauvinistic language here because the king, that was King Xerxes. And we know that from chapter 1 in the way that he treated Queen Vashti. His attitude was that she was an object of beauty, one of his many possessions, perhaps his favourite, best possession. Instead, and you know, that's the way it was, he saw her as a possession and give little, if not any, thought to her to be treated as a person and what she would think, to be brought in and have to perform in front of this drunken lot. Now, instead of upholding the social norms or the historical social norms and expectations of a queen at that time, she spurns the king, which is obviously a very dangerous thing to do, and it took tremendous guts to protest, and especially when you thread through that narrative the fact that it was a bit shame and honour culture. To dishonour the king, well, usually meant that. So she takes a stand, and she doesn't go before the king, before the supreme ruler. Now, what's the king going to do? Well, after consulting with his guys, they're concerned that the insubordination of the queen would spread through all the households in the kingdom and would undermine, if the king can't control his wife, well, that's it. You know, it would be a reflection on the king and his kingdom. It would cause division, discord, and all husbands would be defied, and it was total chaos. So on their advice, the king removes the queen, removes her title, and banishes her far away, never to be seen or heard from again. Chapter 1. This rate will be finished in about 10 minutes, okay? Anyway, chapter 2. King Xerxes comes home after a military campaign against the Greeks. He, unfortunately for him, gets whipped by the Greeks, and he comes back, and chapter 2 is 3 to 4 years later than chapter 1. You still with me? Okay, just. Not falling asleep yet. Anyway, the king's dejected. He's feeling a bit sad. His ego is a bit deflated. Remember, he's a guy who gets himself pumped up. And chapter 2, verse 1, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. He was likely reminiscing about her beauty and thinking about, oh no, I wish I didn't get plastered then. Oh no, and I've banished her. And because he was an all-powerful king, he was actually caught in his own web, because in the law of the Medes and Persians, they couldn't repeal or revoke a law that was made, and he was caught in his own power. He couldn't reverse the edict. He could never get the queen that he loved back. So the attendants around the king, and they realise he needs a wee bit of a boost, he's feeling a wee bit down, and suggest they have a beauty contest. Well, I don't know if any of you have plugged into Britain's Got Talent. Well, this is Persia's Got Talent. Or in our home, what was very popular was the X Factor. I don't think it's on anymore, but I'd endure a few episodes of it now and again. But that's it. Anyway. But we're going to call this the Xerxes Factor, or we could call it the X Factor here. He has an X Factor, an Xerxes Factor, okay? So he's perked up at the thought of having a beauty contest, and he gives the order to gather around all the beauties in this vast empire to join his harem. Now, the Jewish historian Josephus says that in his book, record, says there were about 400 women who came to be part of this X Factor beauty contest. And they came before the panel. Well, panel is a very small panel. It's actually just one. It's the king himself. And now, there's a wee bit of a downside about this, because once you become part of the beauty contest, you're taken into the king's harem, and you can never go back to your normal way of life, because that would dishonour the king. So you're kind of stuck, and if you get rejected, that's you stuck. You'll never marry, that's you had it. Anyway, that's a bit of a downside for that. Or if the king thought that you had some talent, you might get a callback. Or as an occasional space filler for a wee performance for a space filler. And that's what they do in like X Factor 2, isn't it? They bring previous contestants that didn't make it back in for a repeat performance. But if you were really lucky, you got to become one of his wives and a slot in his regular schedule. Whereas the winner, the number one, the star, now I'm going to use this word star later, we're going to come to that, the star of the competition, or the X Factor, would be crowned Queen, Mrs. X, with all the pomp and ceremony, position, prestige, and privileges that go along with it. Now, there is going to be some spiritual application if we just hold on. I think. Esther is a Jewish girl, we read, and she was brought up by her older uncle Mordecai. Verse 7 says that Esther was lovely in form and feature, which the next sermon we're going to go into in great depth. She had it all, and she was chosen to join the king's harem to go to the next stage in the competition. And Esther went through all the beauty regime. She was fully compliant, which we're going to talk about at another point. She took on board absolutely everything that the head of the harem had said to her. And at the end of the year of the beauty regime, the big night came. And she lived up to her Persian name, which means star. Her Jewish name is Hadassah. But Star, that's what her name was, Star, she shone brighter than all other contestants, and Mr. X was so impressed that he considered her to have the X factor, and he made her queen of Persia. Now, the book of Esther is very significant because there's no mention of God in the book. So why are we, I think I'm right in saying, Laurie will correct me, but I think Luther didn't actually ever preach, and I'm not sure about Calvin, you'll tell me later, I'm sure, with Calvin what he thought about, but certainly Luther was not impressed with the book of Esther and never preached on it because God is not mentioned. However, there's two places where you would expect God to be mentioned, but he isn't. For instance, when Mordecai, later in the book, goes into sackcloth and ashes and mourning, always that's associated with a Jew, with prayer. It's not mentioned. Prayer is not mentioned. Did the author of the book of Esther, did he just forget and say, whoops, oh, forgot to put God in the book? I don't think so. I think there's actually a reason for this, and it was intentional to accentuate a truth which we're going to look at today. One point today, you'd be pleased, one point. So anyway, what happens in the book, as it unfolds, God's chosen people are in a very dodgy position. They're in grave danger as the book unfolds. A political figure conspires to annihilate them, just like the Nazis in Nazi Germany and Europe, to try with a final solution to eradicate all the Jews in the Second World War. So here we have a spirit of the Antichrist working through to try to eliminate God's people to stop ultimately the Messiah coming, God's promises being fulfilled. So that's what we've got as a kind of a underlying truth here that's going on. Right. In the book, there is no miraculous intervention from God, which you would expect. His promises are on the line. The Jews are going to be annihilated. You would expect God to pull out the stops and defend his people. No mention, no miracles, no plagues, no fire from heaven, nothing visible. Why not? First, one point. We put the point on. One point, there's some point later, but hold on to that. When God seems absent, he's always present and working out his purposes. That's the sermon today. The theme of the book is a doctrine, or the truth, we can use truth, of God's providence. He's a promise keeper. Providence consists of two words for English scholars here. Susie will keep me right later on. Pro, meaning in front of or behind, pro, and the Latin videre, which means to see. Providence, to see beforehand, to see beforehand. And in his providence, if we can get the next subpoint, here we go. God takes steps in advance to provide for his people and fulfill his purposes. That's kind of my take on R.C. Sproul's on his book on the Westminster Confession, which talks about the providence of God. God takes steps in advance to provide for his people to fulfill his purposes. Providences of God is often hidden. We can't see God at work. It's not just mere foreknowledge or limited to God's ability to see in the future, but God's care and supervision of us and the world. Now, the Westminster Confession says, his wise, holy and sovereign care by which he upholds, directs, disposes and governs all creatures, actions and things from the greatest to the least, according to his infallible foreknowledge and immutable will, his unchanging will, for the praise of his wisdom, power, justice, goodness and mercy. I'm not going to give you more, there's more ones I've got, but your head will be blown away. Anyway, it's all for God's glory. He provides for his people and fulfills his promises. And the ultimate end is that we stand in awe of God and who he is. Now, as some of you are probably falling asleep by now, I'm going to just give a wee story here. I was thinking there's many things I could say, but I've got to keep them for later because there's going to be providence of God kind of running through this book. So here's a little one which I was just thinking about, which might be helpful to us. A wee story. During my university course, I had to do a year, a practical year out, and my responsibility to find a position. However, it turned out that my dad phoned one night and said that he was speaking to somebody through work and that this person said there might be a position for me if I applied for the job. And I duly did, went for an interview and got the job. And it was really good because I could stay at home and the rent was cheap. In fact, it was zero. And the pay was good. And I remember one day, the first day at the start was 8:45. It just about killed me getting up that early. And at the end of the day, at 5 o'clock, I thought, how on earth am I going to go through this 5 days a week? One day felt like forever from being a student. But anyway, I managed to keep going. And weeks went by and months went by. And during that year, there was Evangelist Graham. He was holding various meetings throughout the UK. And there were satellite link-ups. Some of you would remember, you were there. Satellite link-ups throughout the UK to watch Billy Graham, listen to him. So I asked people in my office, I asked everyone in the office, 35 people, personal invites, if they would come along to Billy Graham with me. And some said, yeah, they would consider it. They took invitations. Some said they were definitely coming. And there was only one person who said, absolutely, no, I'm not coming to that. And his name was Douglas Reed. Now, you'll forget this, for those of you who don't know, you'll find out later. And he was a rather prickly character in his mid-50s, and I didn't really know what to make of him. And I asked a few folks at work why about him, and they said, well, actually, he was married with children, and he had left his wife and his daughters and went off with another woman and had moved out of the area. And I put two and two together and I thought, oh, well, probably he doesn't want to come to the event because he might be feeling a bit guilty or he's running from God or whatever. Well, it came near the big event and it was a satellite link-up. There was two, I can remember, in Sutherland, particularly close to where we were. And he asked me, he said, who is all going to the event with you? And I said, well, out of 35, it's a big fat zero. Right? And he commented, you must be really disappointed that you've asked so many people and they said they were coming and they didn't come. And I said, well, I suppose, but I've just done what I can and that's all I can do. Then came the rather surprise. He said, I'm vice convener of the union, and he said, I support minority groups, whether it's grace or race or sexuality or disability, and he said, you're in a minority group of one in this office as a Christian, so he said, I'm going to support you because of my union ethics, and I'm coming along. I thought, oh, great. Anyway, the only thing he said was, there was one caveat, and he said, I'm going to go to this meeting, but you must never, ever ask me to any other religious church meeting again. Understood? Never mention it. And I went, okay. Anyway, he came to the meeting, I never mentioned it, and then anyway, that was it. A few days later, there was a final event in Fountain Road in Golspie, and I was standing outside on the A9 at my mum's house, and waiting to go with a youth group to the meeting, and who appears, this car drew up into the off the road, the passing place, and it was Douglas, and he was dressed up, shirt and tie, sports jacket on, and I said, what's on tonight, where are you off to? And he said, oh, I've got a meeting on. I said, all right, okay. And I said, oh, where is that? And he said, oh, it's in Golspie. Guess what? Same meeting. Anyway, I was desperate to try and sit beside him, but I couldn't because I was with this youth group, and I went, oh, disaster. Oh, I can't sit beside him. He's going to be on his own. He had a reputation within the community, and I thought it's going to be so hard for him walking in with all the people. I was on the gallery looking down. Hall was packed, absolutely packed to the gunnels, and down below me, there was Douglas. I saw him, and there was one seat either side of him that was empty. I went, disaster. Nobody wants to sit next to him. Unknown to me, he had prayed, God, if you really are there, I don't want anybody to sit next to me. True story. True story. God, his providence, his sovereignty, his care. And to cut a long story short, he came to faith in Jesus. He repented and believed in the Lord Jesus Christ. And he became a very, very dear friend. He became an elder in this church. And the Lord took him home years later. In his providence and foresight, God takes steps in advance to provide for his people and to fulfill his purposes. God's invisible hand. My dad's contact got me a job, the interview, the meeting, the Billy Graham event, Douglas coming, fellowship being formed, you being here today. That's just one little tiny thing that we can see. Now, I'm running out of time here, folks, today. For Christians, God's hidden hand or semi-hidden hands wrapping around you, caring for you, supporting you, lifting up you, cradling you when you're broken and hurting, and instilling grace to flow through you, to enable you to go through things, to protect you from temptation that you can't cope with, but only allowing what you can deal with to come into your life. Everything goes through the hands of God before it comes to you. He's providing for you. He's giving to you. He knows in advance the very last breath you're going to take, the very first breath you took. He knew you before you were born. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you and set you apart. In our lives, when we consider, we can sometimes look back and we can see God's hand of his care and love providing for us, our friends, our family, our children, our physical needs, our spiritual needs. And I see in my life people that come into my life to encourage me spiritually, to help me, to spur me on to love and good deeds, to support me, to comfort me. And that's not with me, it's with you too, because we're all loved by God. Regarding Esther, when God seems absent, he's always present and working out his purposes. Of course, God's providence is mysterious. We have lots of questions, some fearful, some confusing. But just because we don't understand or comprehend this truth doesn't really mean a thing. It's still true if we accept it or submit to it or we don't. And just because we don't see or perceive God's hand at work doesn't mean he's not working. Now, did God's people at the time of Esther see the danger at the start of the chapter, the beginning of this event? No. They didn't see it. They didn't see that there was a political figure that was going to try and annihilate them. They didn't see it. We don't know what God is doing in our family. Difficult events can happen. Troubling times. Times of suffering and difficulty. And we think disaster. But is it? With God's, when we pray and we commit ourselves and our loved ones and our friends to God, we're making a difference. We're calling upon the sovereign God of the universe. Nothing takes God by surprise. You know, in this story, was working, and he had agents in place. As we read through the story, he had the secret agents in place that were going to... They were sleeper agents, literally, spiritually, they were sleeping, which we're going to look at later. But at the right time, at the right moment, they come alive by God's working and his spirit, and they do what he wants them to do so his purposes and promises can be fulfilled. At the end of the book, we're going to discover a whole series of coincidences that happen. And if they didn't all happen, the Jews would have been wiped out. For those of you who have read through the book already, you know the story. If the king hadn't got drunk and he hadn't wanted to display Queen Vashti, then Esther, and she was banished, Esther would not be in a position later on in time to help the Jewish people. And note, King Xerxes made a free decision by his advisors. He wasn't a puppet on a string by God, and he listened to his advisors and he made the decree to banish Queen Vashti. And what if Esther hadn't been an absolute stunner? What if the head of the harem, Haggai, didn't take a shine to Esther and give her preferential treatment and special intel to know how to please the king? She wouldn't have been made queen. And what if Mordecai hadn't heard the plot which you read about here for the assassination of the king? And we'll see later on that even though the king knew Mordecai had what he had done, the king forgot to honour him, but remembered at the right moment when he was reading a really boring book of his chronicles and wanted to go to sleep, then he came across this, that Mordecai, and honoured Mordecai, which set a series of events in place. Now, these, all the things that happened were just ordinary little things that seemed so insignificant, but when God works in an extraordinary way, we say, oh, God's working, we can see him, he's working, and there's something miraculous happens, and we think, oh yeah, he's working now, it's okay, relax. But when God works in an ordinary way, in the silent, in an ordinary way, we don't think he's working. We don't even think he's there sometimes. We doubt he's there. But he's working out your salvation, my salvation, and being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. He's working out and keeping his promises, even when it all appears he's nowhere around. He's working. Are you doubting that God's working in you, in your family, in your community, in this country? Going through difficult things, difficult times? Sometimes we're looking back, we can see. What was he doing in your journey in coming to faith? When you look back, who did he bring into your life? What series of events brought you to faith? Or what things are happening just now that you are embracing and opening yourself up to God to be transformed by his Spirit so the promises of God are fulfilled in your life? Now, if we think on Jesus, did it look like God was working when one of his disciples betrayed him, Judas? Did it look like God was working when Peter denied Jesus? Did it look like God was working when all the disciples fled and left Jesus? Or when Jesus was arrested and he was tried and innocent, yet they said he was guilty, and he was led to a cross and he was hung naked on a cross? Did it look like God was really working? When the soldiers mocked him and said, sure, you're God's rescuing king. Did it seem that God was absent? Yes. But, you know something? They were all wrong, because God was working like he never worked before. He was bringing about the salvation of the world and a way of opportunity for all to enter through faith and trust in Jesus and their sins forgiven. Probably, perhaps, mainly the only two people who saw God working might have been Mary Magdalene and Jesus' mother. Jesus had repeatedly told disciples that he would suffer at the hands of religious leaders and Gentiles, and he would die and he would raise back to life again by through the power of the Holy Spirit. But it wasn't until after the resurrection that they could see, his own disciples and his own family saw, that what God had done at the cross, and he was the Messiah. The ultimate end of God's providence is that the name, God's name, would be glorified. And it's for our good. Are you resting in the providence of God today? It's so good we can rest in God's providence in the chaos and difficulties of life, and we can rest in His sovereignty. When God seems absent, He's always present working out His purposes. You know, note, God did have His sleeper agents, but at the right time, they came into action and did what the possible, they did what the possible they possibly could, and they left it all the mysterious and possible to God. Are you doing the possible in your life to fulfill what God wants you to be, most importantly to be, and to do for Him? I'm going to finish now with a wee quote from Alistair Begg. Well, it's not a wee quote, it's quite a long quote. But that's it. You see, even when it's obvious to us that the wicked flourish, that evil people seem to be in ascendancy, that bad seems to be called good, and good seems to be called bad, even when we're disheartened, even when it appears that everything seems to be crooked and irregular, the doctrine of providence is in the Bible to say to us, remember that God is actually sovereign over all these affairs. An excerpt here from Thomas Watson in his Body of Divinity. Suppose you are in a blacksmith's shop and should see there several sorts of tools, some crooked, some bowed, others hooked. Would you condemn all these things because they don't look handsome? The smith makes use of them all for doing his work. Thus it is with the providence of God. They seem to us to be very crooked and strange, yet they all carry on God's work. And just to finish Alistair Begg again, if we don't understand this, if we don't come to terms with this, it will have implications in every dimension of our lives. In dealing with sadness, in dealing with suffering, in dealing with the ongoing political machinations of our world, and most pressingly, of our nation. When we read our Bibles, it's clear that God often in history has made use of the wicked, sometimes to protect and shield His people, and other times to purify and refine His people. Right? How else do you understand the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar and the forces of the Babylon carrying His people away into exile? Anybody on that day would say, this is a disaster, and viewed it in the immediacy of it. Surely it was a trial. But from the vantage point of the backward glance, we see what God was doing. Even when we're disheartened, and it appears that everything is so crooked and irregular, the doctrine of providence is in the Bible to say to us, remember that God is actually sovereign over all these affairs. Some of us actually are so proud that we're tempted to think that we could order things better if we had the government of the world in our hands. We talk like that, don't we? So silly. You can't even match a pair of socks that came out of your tumble dryer. And you want to run the universe? I like that quote. It is tough, though, getting socks, isn't it? We would harm ourselves if we were able to make our own decisions. We would make wrong decisions. Conclusion. Are you seeing this as a disaster in your life just now? Where is God? I think we all say that at times, don't we? Where is God? God's absence is never true. His silence is not absence. His hiddenness is not abandonment. When God seems silent, He's always present. God seems absent, He's always present and working out His purposes. So let's relax into His providence. Do what we should do. Do the next right thing, read the word, pray, seek as much fellowship as we can, be hungry for fellowship, and do the possible, and leave the impossible to God, and relax into sovereign grace. Amen.